Burning sweetgrass. A sweetgrass braid is burned to create a ceremonial smudge that washes the recipient in kindness and compassion to heal the body and the spirit. Wendigo footprints. In the winter brilliance, the only sounds are the rub of my jacket against itself, the soft plump of my snowshoes, the rifle-shot crack of trees bursting their hearts in the freezing temperatures, and the beating of my own heart, pumping hot blood, fingers still tingling in double mittens. In the break between squalls, the sky is painfully blue. The snowfields sparkle below like shattered glass. This last storm has sculpted the drifts like surf on a frozen sea. Earlier, my tracks were filled with pink and yellow shadows. Now they deepen to blue in the fading light. I walk alongside fox tracks, vole tunnels, and a bright red spatter in the snow, framed by the imprint of hawk wings. Everybody's hungry. When the wind picks up again, I can smell more snow coming, and within minutes the squall line roars over the treetops, carrying flakes like a gray curtain blowing straight at me. I turn to get to shelter before full dark, retracing my steps, which have already begun to fill. When I look more closely, I can see that inside each of my tracks is another print that is not my tread. I scan the growing darkness for a figure, but the snow is too heavy to see. The trees thrash beneath racing clouds. A howl rises behind me. Maybe it's just the wind. It's on nights like this that the Wendigo is afoot. You can hear its unearthly shrieks as it hunts through the blizzard. The Wendigo is the legendary monster of our Anishinaabe people, the villain of a tale told on freezing nights in the North Woods. You can feel it lurking behind you, a being in the shape of an outsized man, 10 feet tall, with frost-white hair hanging from its shaking body. With arms like tree trunks, feet as big as snowshoes, it travels easily through the blizzards of the hungry time, stalking us. The hideous stench of its carrion breath poisons the clean scent of snow as it pants behind us. Yellow fangs hang from its mouth that is raw where it has chewed off its lips from hunger. Most telling of all, its heart is made of ice. Wendigo stories were told around the fire to scare children into safe behavior, lest this Ojibwe boogeyman make a meal of them, or worse. This monster is no bear or howling wolf, no natural beast. Wendigos are not born. They are made. The Wendigo is a human being who has become a cannibal monster. Its bite will transform victims into cannibals, too. When I come in from the rising blizzard and peel off my ice-coated clothes, there is a fire in the wood stove and a simmering pot of stew. It wasn't always that way for our people, when the storms would bury the lodges and the food was gone. They named this time, when the snow is too deep and the deer are gone and the caches are empty, the hunger moon. It is the time when an elder leaves to hunt and never returns. When sucking a bone is not enough, the infants follow. After too many days, desperation is the only soup. Starvation in winter was a reality for our people, particularly in the era of the Little Ice Age, when winters were especially hard and long. Some scholars suggest that Wendigo mythology also spread quickly in the time of the fur trade, when overexploitation of game brought famine to the villages. The ever-present fear of winter famine is embodied in the icy hunger and gaping maw of the Wendigo. As the monster shrieked on the wind, the Wendigo stories reinforced the taboo against cannibalism, when the madness of hunger and isolation rustled at the edge of winter lodges. Succumbing to such a repulsive urge doomed the gnawer of bones to wander as a wendigo for the rest of time. It is said that the wendigo will never enter the spirit world, but will suffer the eternal pain of need, its essence a hunger that will never be sated. The more a wendigo eats, the more ravenous it becomes. It shrieks with its craving, its mind a torture of unmet want. Consumed by consumption, it lays waste to humankind. But the wendigo is more than just a mythic monster intended to frighten children. Creation stories offer a glimpse into the worldview of a people, of how they understand themselves, their place in the world, and the ideals to which they aspire. Likewise, the collective fears and deepest values of a people are also seen in the visage of the monsters they create. Born of our fears and our failings, Wendigo is the name for that within us which cares more for its own survival than for anything else. In terms of system science, the Wendigo is a case study of a positive feedback loop in which a change in one entity promotes a similar change in another connected part of the system. In this case, an increase in Wendigo hunger causes an increase in Wendigo eating, and that increased eating promotes only more rampant hunger in an eventual frenzy of uncontrolled consumption. In the natural as well as the built environment, positive feedback leads inexorably to change, sometimes to growth, sometimes to destruction. When growth is unbalanced, however, you can't always tell the difference. Stable, balanced systems are typified by negative feedback loops, in which a change in one component incites an opposite change in another, so they balance each other out. When hunger causes increased eating, eating causes decreased hunger. Satiety is possible. Negative feedback is a form of reciprocity, a coupling of forces that create balance and sustainability. Wendigo stories sought to encourage negative feedback loops in the minds of listeners. Traditional upbringing was designed to strengthen self-discipline, to build resistance against the insidious germ of taking too much. The old teachings recognize that Wendigo nature is in each of us. So the monster was created in stories that we might learn why we should recoil from that greedy part of ourselves. This is why Anishinaabe elders like Stuart King remind us to always acknowledge the two faces, the light and the dark side of life, in order to understand ourselves. See the dark, recognize its power, but do not feed it. The beast has been called an evil spirit that devours mankind. The very word Wendigo, according to Ojibwe scholar Basil Johnston, can be derived from roots meaning fat excess or thinking only of oneself. Writer Steve Pitt says that a Wendigo was a human whose selfishness has overpowered their self-control to the point that satisfaction is no longer possible. No matter what they call it, Johnston and many other scholars point to the current epidemic of self-destructive practices, addiction to alcohol, drugs, gambling, technology, and more, as a sign that Wendigo is alive and well. In Ojibwe ethics, Pitt says, any overindulgent habit is self-destructive, and self-destruction is Wendigo. And just as Wendigo's bite is infectious, we all know too well that self-destruction drags along many more victims in our human families as well as in the more-than-human world. The native habitat of the Wendigo is the North Woods, but the range has expanded in the last few centuries. As Johnston suggests, multinational corporations have spawned a new breed of Wendigo that insatiably devours the Earth's resources, not for need, but for greed. The footprints are all around us, once you know what to look for. Our plane had to land for repairs on a short paved strip in the jungle at the heart of the Ecuadorian Amazon oil fields, a few miles from the Colombian border. We flew in over unbroken rainforest, following the river shining like a blue satin ribbon below. But the water abruptly turned black when we flew over the raw gashes of red soil, marking the paths of pipelines. Our hotel was on a dirt street, where dead dogs and prostitutes shared the corners under a perpetually orange sky lit by the flaring stacks. When we got the room key, the concierge told us to push a dresser against the door and not leave our rooms during the night. In the lobby was a cage of scarlet macaws, staring dully at the street where half-naked children were begging and AK-47s hung from the shoulders of boys no older than 12, standing guard outside the houses of the narco-traffickers. We passed the night without incident. The next morning, we flew out as the sun rose over the steaming jungle. Below us was the snarling town, ringed with rainbow-colored lagoons of petrochemical waste, too many to count. The footprints of the Wendigo. They're everywhere you look. They stomp in the industrial sludge of Onondaga Lake, and over a savagely clear-cut slope in the Oregon Coast Range where the earth is slumping into the river. You can see them where coal mines rip off mountaintops in West Virginia and in oil-slick footprints on the beaches of the Gulf of Mexico. A square mile of industrial soybeans, a diamond mine in Rwanda, a closet stuffed with clothes. Wendigo footprints all. They are the tracks of insatiable consumption. So many have been bitten. You can see them walking the malls, eyeing your farm for a housing development, running for Congress. We are all complicit. We have allowed the market to define what we value, so that the redefined common good seems to depend on profligate lifestyles that enrich the sellers while impoverishing the soul and the earth. Cautionary Wendigo tales arose in a commons-based society where sharing was essential to survival, and greed made any individual a danger to the whole. In the old times, individuals who endangered the community by taking too much for themselves were first counseled, then ostracized, and if the greed continued, they were eventually banished. The Wendigo myth may have arisen from the remembrance of the banished, doomed to wander hungry and alone, wreaking vengeance on the ones who spurned them. It is a terrible punishment to be banished from the web of reciprocity with no one to share with you and no one for you to care for. I remember walking a street in Manhattan where the warm light of a lavish home spilled out over the sidewalk on a man picking through the garbage for his dinner. Maybe we've all been banished to lonely corners by our obsession with private property. We've accepted banishment even from ourselves when we spend our beautiful, utterly singular lives on making more money to buy more things that feed but never satisfy. It is the Wendigo way that tricks us into believing that belongings will fill our hunger when it is belonging that we crave. On a grander scale, too, we seem to be living in an era of Wendigo economics, of fabricated demand and compulsive overconsumption. What native peoples once sought to rein in, we are now asked to unleash in a systematic policy of sanctioned greed. The fear for me is far greater than just acknowledging the Wendigo within. The fear for me is that the world has been turned inside out, the dark side made to seem light. Indulgent self-interest that our people once held to be monstrous is now celebrated as success. We are asked to admire what our people viewed as unforgivable. The consumption-driven mindset masquerades as quality of life, but eats us from within. It is as if we've been invited to a feast, but the table is laid with food that nourishes only emptiness, the black hole of the stomach that never fills. We have unleashed a monster. Ecological economists argue for reforms that would ground economics in ecological principles and the constraints of thermodynamics. They urge the embrace of the radical notion that we must sustain natural capital and ecosystem services if we are to maintain quality of life. But governments still cling to the neoclassical fallacy that human consumption has no consequences. We continue to embrace economic systems that prescribe infinite growth on a finite planet, as if somehow the universe had repealed the laws of thermodynamics on our behalf. Perpetual growth is simply not compatible with natural law. And yet, a leading economist like Lawrence Summers of Harvard, the World Bank, and the U.S. National Economic Council issue such statements as, "There are no limits to the carrying capacity of the Earth that are likely to bind at any time in the foreseeable future." The idea that we should put limits on growth because of some natural limit is a profound error. Our leaders willfully ignore the wisdom and the models of every other species on the planet, except, of course, those that have gone extinct. Wendigo thinking. The Sacred and the Superfund. Above the spring behind my house, a drop forms at the end of a mossy branch, hangs in a momentary sparkle, and then lets go. Other drips and drops join in the procession, just a few of the hundreds of rivulets from these hills. Gathering speed, they splish over rocky ledges with growing urgency to be on their way, down Nine Mile Creek, until they find Onondaga Lake. I cup my hands to the spring and drink. Knowing what I know, I worry about the journey these drops will soon take, wanting to hold them here forever. But there is no stopping water. The watershed of my home in upstate New York lies within the ancestral homelands of the Onondaga people, the central fire of the Iroquois or Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Traditional Onondaga understand a world in which all beings were given a gift that simultaneously engenders a responsibility to the world. Water's gift is its role as life sustainer, and its duties are manifold, making plants grow, creating home for fish and mayflies, and for me today, offering a cool drink. The particular sweetness of this water comes from the surrounding hills, great shoulders of inordinately pure, fine-grained limestone. These old sea floors are almost pure calcium carbonate, with scarcely a trace of other elements to discolor their pearly gray. Other springs in these hills are less sweet, emerging from limestone shelves that hide salt-filled caverns, crystal palaces lined with cubes of halite. The Onondaga use these salt springs to season their corn soup and venison and preserve the baskets of fish the waters offered up. Life was good, and water rushed off to do its work, faithful to its responsibility every day. But people are not always as mindful as water. We can forget. And so the Haudenosaunee were given the Thanksgiving address to remind themselves to greet and thank all of the members of the natural world whenever they gathered. To the waters they say, We give thanks to all the waters of the world. We are grateful that the waters are still here and doing their duty of sustaining life on Mother Earth. Water is life, quenching our thirst and providing us with strength, making the plants grow and sustaining us all. Let us gather our minds together, and with one mind, we send greetings and thanks to the waters. These words reflect the sacred purpose of the people. For just as water was given certain responsibilities for sustaining the world, so were the people. Chief among their duties was to give thanks for the gifts of the earth and to care for them. Stories are told of long ago times when the Haudenosaunee people did forget to live in gratitude. They became greedy and jealous and began fighting among themselves. Conflict brought only more conflict, until war between the nations became continuous. Soon grief was known in every longhouse, and yet the violence went on. All were suffering. During that sorry time, a son was born to a Huron woman, far to the west. This handsome youth grew to manhood, knowing that he had a special purpose. One day, he explained to his family that he must leave home to carry a message to people in the east, a message from the Creator. He built a great canoe, carved of white stone, and journeyed far until at last he pulled his boat ashore in the midst of the warring Haudenosaunee. Here he spoke his message of peace and became known as the Peacemaker. Few heeded him at first, but those who listened were transformed. His life in danger, weighed down with sorrow, the Peacemaker and his allies, among them the real Hiawatha, spoke peace in times of terrible trouble. For years they traveled between villages, and one by one, the chiefs of the warring nations came to accept the message of peace, all but one. Tododaho, an Onondaga leader, refused the way of peace for his people. He was so filled with hate that his hair writhed with snakes and his body was crippled by vitriol. Tododaho sent death and sorrow to the carriers of the message. But the peace was more powerful than he, and eventually the Onondaga, too, accepted the message of peace. Tododaho's twisted body was restored to health, and together the messengers of peace combed the snakes from his hair. He, too, was transformed. The Peacemaker gathered together the leaders of all five Haudenosaunee nations and joined them with one mind. The great tree of peace, an enormous white pine, has five long green needles joined in one bundle, representing the unity of the five nations. With one hand, the Peacemaker lifted the great tree from the soil, and the assembled chiefs stepped forward to cast their weapons of war into the hole. On this very shore, the nations agreed to bury the hatchet and live by the great law of peace, which sets out right relations among peoples and with the natural world. Four white roots spread out to the four directions, inviting all peace-loving nations to shelter under the tree's branches. So was born the great Haudenosaunee Confederacy, the oldest living democracy on the planet. It was here, at Onondaga Lake, where this great law was born. For its pivotal role, the Onondaga Nation became the central fire of the Confederacy, and from that time forward, the name Tododaho has been carried by the spiritual leader of the Confederacy. As a final measure, the Peacemaker placed the far-seeing eagle atop the great tree to warn the people of approaching danger. For the many centuries that followed, the eagle did its work, and the Haudenosaunee people lived in peace and prosperity. But then another danger, a different kind of violence, came to their homelands. The great bird must have called and called, but its voice was lost in the maelstrom winds of change. Today, the ground where the peacemaker walked is a Superfund site. In fact, 9 Superfund sites line the shore of Onondaga Lake, around which the present-day city of Syracuse, New York, has grown. Thanks to more than a century of industrial development, the lake, known as one of North America's most sacred sites, is now known as one of the most polluted lakes in the United States. Drawn by abundant resources and the coming of the Erie Canal, the captains of industry brought their innovations to Onondaga territory. Early journals record that smokestacks made the air a choking miasma. The manufacturers were happy to have Onondaga Lake so close at hand to use as a dumping ground. Millions of tons of industrial waste were slurried onto the lake bottom. The growing city followed suit, adding sewage to the suffering of the waters. It is as if the newcomers to Onondaga Lake had declared war, not on each other, but with the land. Today, the land where the peacemaker walked and the Tree of Peace stood isn't land at all, but beds of industrial waste, 60 feet deep. It sticks to shoes like thick white school paste used in kindergartens to glue cutout birds onto construction paper trees. There aren't too many birds here, and the Tree of Peace is buried. The original people could no longer find even the familiar curve of the shore. The old contours were filled in, creating a new shoreline of more than a mile of waste beds. It has been said that the waste beds made new land, but that is a lie. The waste beds are actually old land, chemically rearranged. This greasy sludge used to be limestone and fresh water and rich soil. The new terrain is old land that has been pulverized, extracted, and poured out the end of a pipe. It is known as Solvay waste, after the Solvay process company that left it behind. The Solvay process was a chemical breakthrough that allowed for the production of soda ash, an essential component of other industrial processes such as glass manufacturing and making detergents, pulp, and paper. Native limestone was melted in coke-fired furnaces and then reacted with salt to produce soda ash. This industry fueled the growth of the whole region, and chemical processing expanded to include organic chemicals, dyes, and chlorine gas. Train lines ran steadily past the factories, shipping out tons of products. Pipes ran in the other direction, pouring out tons of waste. The hills of waste are the topographic inverse of the open pit mines, the largest open pit mines in New York State, still unreclaimed. Where the limestone rocks were quarried, the earth gouged out in one place to bury the ground in another. If time could run backward, like a film in reverse, we would see this mess reassemble itself into lush green hills and moss-covered ledges of limestone. The streams would run back up the hills to the springs, and the salt would stay glittering in underground rooms. I can too easily imagine what it must have been like, those first ejections from the pipe falling in chalky white splats like the droppings of an enormous mechanical bird, splurting and pulsing at first with air in the mile-long intestine that stretched back to the gut of the factory. But it would soon settle into a steady flow, burying the reeds and rushes. Did the frogs and mink get away in time to avoid being entombed? What about the turtles? Too slow. They wouldn't be able to escape being embedded at the bottom of the pile in a perversion of the story of the world's creation when the earth was carried on turtles' back. First, they filled in the lakeshore itself, sending tons of sludge into the waters in a plume that turned blue water to white paste. Then they moved the end of the pipe to the surrounding wetlands, right up to the edges of the stream. The water of Nine Mile Creek must have wanted to head back uphill to defy gravity and find again the mossy pools beneath the springs. But it kept to its work and found its way, seeping through the waste beds and out to the lake. Rain bound for waste beds is in trouble too. At first, the waste particles are so fine that they trap the water in white clay. Then gravity eventually pulls the drops through 60 feet of sludge and out the bottom of the pile to join a drainage ditch instead of a stream. As it passes through the chalky depths, the rain cannot help doing what it has been called to do, dissolving minerals, carrying ions intended to nurture plants and fish. By the time it reaches the bottom of the heap, the water has picked up enough chemicals to be as salty as soup and as corrosive as lye. Its beautiful name, water, is lost. It's now called leachate. Leachate seeps from the waste beds with a pH of 11. Like drain cleaner, it will burn your skin. Normal drinking water has a pH value of 7. Today, engineers collect the leachate and mix it with hydrochloric acid in order to neutralize the pH. It is then released to Nine Mile Creek and out into Onondaga Lake. The water has been tricked. It started on its way, full of innocence, full of its own purpose. Through no fault of its own, it has been corrupted, and instead of being a bearer of life, it must now deliver poison. And yet it cannot stop itself from flowing. It must do what it must do with the gifts bestowed upon it by the Creator. It's only people who have a choice. Today, you can drive a motorboat on the lake the Peacemaker paddled. From across the water, the western shore stands out in sharp relief. Bright white bluffs gleam in the summer sun like the white cliffs of Dover. But when you approach by water, you'll see that the cliffs are not rock at all, but sheer walls of Solvay waste. While your boat bobs on the waves, you can see erosion gullies in the wall, the weather conspiring to mix the waste into the lake. Summer sun dries out the pasty surface until it blows, and sub-zero winter temperatures fracture it off in plates that fall to the water. A beach beckons around the point, but there are no swimmers, no docks. This bright white expanse is a flat plain of waste that slumped into the water when a retaining wall collapsed many years ago. A white pavement of settled waste extends far out from shore, barely underwater. The smooth shelf is punctuated by cobble-sized rocks, ghostly beneath the water, unlike any rock you know. These are oncolites, accretions of calcium carbonate that pepper the lake bottom. Oncolites, tumorous rocks. Pilings stick up through the flat like a backbone, remnants of the old retaining wall. Here and there, rusted pipes that carried the sludge stick out at odd angles. Where the sludge piles meet the flats of Solvay, there are small trickling seeps that are eerily reminiscent of springs, but the liquid that emerges seems slightly thicker than water. There are plates of summer ice along the little rivulets that drain toward the lake, crystal sheets made of salt, beneath which the water bubbles like a melting stream at the end of winter. The waste beds continue to leach tons of salt into the lake every year. Before the Allied Chemical Company, successor to Solvay Process, ceased operation, the salinity of Onondaga Lake was 10 times the salinity of the headwaters of Nine Mile Creek. The salt, the oncolites, and the waste impede the growth of rooted aquatic plants. Lakes rely on their submerged plants to generate oxygen by photosynthesis. Without plants, the depths of Onondaga Lake are oxygen poor, and without swaying beds of vegetation, fish, frogs, insects, herons, the whole food chain are left without habitat. While rooted water plants have a hard time, floating algae flourish in Onondaga Lake. For decades, high quantities of nitrogen and phosphorus from municipal sewage fertilized the lake and fueled their growth. Algae blooms cover the surface of the water, then die and sink to the bottom. Their decay depletes what little oxygen is in the water, and the lake begins to smell of the dead fish that wash up on shore on hot summer days. The fish that survive, you may not eat. Fishing was banned in 1970 due to high concentrations of mercury. It is estimated that 165,000 pounds of mercury were discharged into Onondaga Lake between 1946 and 1970. Allied Chemical used the mercury cell process to produce industrial chlorine from the native salt brines. The mercury waste, which we know to be extremely toxic, was handled freely on its way to disposal in the lake. Local people recall that a kid could make good pocket money on reclaimed mercury. One old-timer told me that you could go out to the waste beds with a kitchen spoon and pick up the small, glistening spheres of mercury that lay on the ground. A kid could fill an old canning jar with mercury and sell it back to the company for the price of a movie ticket. Inputs of mercury were sharply curtailed in the 1970s, but the mercury remains trapped in the sediments. When methylated, it can circulate through the aquatic food chain. It is estimated that 7 million cubic yards of lake sediments are today contaminated with mercury. A sampling core drilled into the lake bottom cuts through sludge, trapped layers of discharged gas, oil, and sticky black ooze. Analysis of these cores reveals significant concentrations of cadmium, barium, chromium, cobalt, lead, benzene, chlorobenzene, assorted xylenes, pesticides, and PCBs. Not many insects, and not many fish. Onondaga Lake in the 1880s was famed for its whitefish, served freshly caught on steaming platters along potatoes boiled in salty brine. Fine restaurants did a booming business along the lakeshore, where tourists came for the scenery, the amusement parks, and picnic grounds where families spread their blankets on a Sunday afternoon. A trolley delivered passengers to the grand hotels that lined its shore. One famed resort, White Beach, featured a long wooden slide lit with strings of glittering gas lights. Holidaymakers would sit in wheeled carts and whoosh down the ramp to splash into the lake below. The resort promised an exhilarating dowsing for ladies, gentlemen, and children of all ages. But swimming was banned in 1940. Beautiful Onondaga Lake. People spoke of it with pride. Now they barely speak of it at all, as if it were a family member whose demise was so shameful that the name never comes up. You would think that such toxic waters would be nearly transparent with the absence of life, but some areas are often nearly opaque with a dark cloud of silt. The turbidity comes from a muddy plume that enters the lake from another tributary, Onondaga Creek. It flows in from the south, from the high ridge above the Tully Valley, from hillsides of forests, farms, and sweet-smelling apple orchards. Muddy water is usually attributed to runoff from farmland, but in this case, the mud comes from below. High in the watershed are the Tully mud boils, which erupt into the creek like mud volcanoes, sending tons of soft sediment downstream. There is some debate as to whether the mud boils are of natural geologic origin. The Onondaga elders remember when, not so long ago, Onondaga Creek ran so clear through their nation that they could spearfish by lantern light. They knew that there was no mud in the creek until salt mining began upstream. When the salt wells near the factories ran out, Allied Chemical used solution mining to access the underground salt deposits up near the headwaters. The company pumped water into subterranean deposits, dissolved them away, and then pumped the brine miles down the valley to the Solvay plant. The brine line was run through the remaining territory of the Onondaga Nation, where breaks in the line ruined the well water. Eventually, the dissolved salt domes collapsed underground, creating holes through which groundwater pushed with high pressure. The resulting gushers created the mud boils that flow downstream and fill the lake with sediment. The creek that was once a fishery for Atlantic salmon, a swimming hole for kids, and a focal point of community life, now runs as brown as chocolate milk. Allied Chemical and its successors deny any role in the formation of the mud boils. They claim it was an act of God. What kind of God would that be? The wounds to these waters are as numerous as the snakes in the Tadadaho's hair, and they must be named before they can be combed out. The ancestral Onondaga territory stretches from the Pennsylvania border north to Canada. It was a mosaic of rich woodlands, expansive cornfields, clear lakes and rivers that sustained the native people for centuries. The original territory also encompasses the site of present-day Syracuse and the sacred shores of Onondaga Lake. Onondaga rights to these lands were guaranteed by treaties between the two sovereign nations, Onondaga Nation and the United States government. But water is more faithful to its responsibilities than the United States would ever be. When George Washington directed federal troops to exterminate the Onondaga during the Revolutionary War, a nation that had numbered in the tens of thousands was reduced to a few hundred people in a matter of 1 year. Afterward, every single treaty was broken. Illegal takings of land by the state of New York diminished the Aboriginal Onondaga territories to a reservation of only 4,300 acres. The Onondaga Nation territory today is not much bigger than the Solvay waste beds. Assaults on Onondaga culture continued. Parents tried to hide their children from Indian agents, but they were taken and sent to boarding schools like Carlisle Indian School. The language that framed the great law of peace was forbidden. Missionaries were dispatched to the matrilineal communities, in which men and women were equal, to show them the error of their ways. Longhouse ceremonies of thanksgiving, ceremonies meant to keep the world in balance, were banned by law. The people have endured the pain of being bystanders to the degradation of their lands, but they never surrendered their caregiving responsibilities. They have continued the ceremonies that honor the land and their connection to it. The Onondaga people still live by the precepts of the great law and still believe that in return for the gifts of Mother Earth, human people have responsibility for caring for the non-human people, for stewardship of the land. Without title to their ancestral lands, however, their hands were tied to protect it. So they watched, powerless, as strangers buried the peacemaker's footsteps. The plants, animals, and waters they were bound to protect dwindled away, though the covenant with the land was never broken. Like the springs above the lake, the people just kept doing what they were called to do, no matter what fate met them downstream. The people went on giving thanks to the land, although so much of the land had little reason to be thankful for the people. generations of grief, generations of loss, but also strength. The people did not surrender. They had spirit on their side. They had their traditional teachings. They also had the law. Onondaga is a rarity in the United States, a native nation that has never surrendered its traditional government, never given up its identity, nor compromised its status as a sovereign nation. Federal laws were ignored by their own authors, but the Onondaga people still live by the precepts of the great law. Out of grief and its strength has come a rising power, a resurgence that became public on March 11, 2005, when the Onondaga Nation filed a complaint in federal court with the goal of reclaiming title to their lost homelands, that they might once again exercise their caregiving responsibilities. While elders passed on and babies became elders, the people held to the dream of regaining their traditional lands, but they had no legal voice by which to do so. The halls of justice were closed to them for decades. As the judicial climate gradually changed to permit tribes to bring federal suit, other Haudenosaunee nations filed claims to recover their lands. The substance of these claims was upheld by the Supreme Court, which ruled that Haudenosaunee lands were illegally taken and the people greatly wronged. Indian lands were unlawfully purchased in contravention of the United States Constitution. New York State has been ordered to forge a settlement, though remedies and reparations have proven difficult to find. Some nations have negotiated land claims for cash payoffs or land gains and casino deals in an effort to find relief from poverty and ensure their cultural survival on the remnants of their territories. Others have sought to reclaim their original lands via outright purchase from willing sellers, land swaps with New York State, or the threat of lawsuits against individual landowners. The Onondaga Nation took a different approach. Their claim was made under United States law, but its moral power lay in the directives of the great law, to act on behalf of peace, the natural world, and future generations. They did not call their suit a land claim because they know that land is not property, but a gift, the sustainer of life. Tadadaho Sidney Hill has said that the Onondaga Nation will never seek to evict people from their homes. The Onondaga people know the pain of displacement too well to inflict it on their neighbors. Instead, the suit was termed a land rights action. The motion began with a statement unprecedented in Indian law. The Onondaga people wished to bring about a healing between themselves and all others who live in this region that has been the homeland of the Onondaga Nation since the dawn of time. The nation and its people have a unique spiritual, cultural, and historic relationship with the land, which is embodied in the Gayanashagoa, the great law of peace. This relationship goes far beyond federal and state legal concerns of ownership, possession, or other legal rights. The people are one with the land and consider themselves stewards of it. It is the duty of the nation's leaders to work for a healing of this land, to protect it, and to pass it on to future generations. The Onondaga Nation brings this action on behalf of its people in the hope that it may hasten the process of reconciliation and bring lasting justice, peace, and respect among all who inhabit this area. The Onondaga Land Rights Action sought legal recognition of title to their home, not to remove their neighbors and not for development of casinos, which they view as destructive to community life. Their intention was to gain the legal standing necessary to move restoration of the land forward. Only with title can they ensure that mines are reclaimed and that Onondaga Lake is cleaned up. Tadadaho Sidney Hill says, "We had to stand by and watch what happens to Mother Earth, but nobody listens to what we think. The land rights action will give us a voice." The list of named defendants was headed by the state of New York, who illegally took the lands. But the suit also listed corporations that have been responsible for degradation, a quarry, a mine, an air-polluting power plant, and the more sweetly named successor to Allied Chemical, Honeywell Incorporated. Even without the suit, Honeywell is finally being held accountable for the late cleanup, but there is great debate about the best approach to dealing with the contaminated sediments so that natural healing can go forward. Dredge, cap, or leave it alone? State, local, and federal environmental agencies are all offering solutions with a range of price tags. The scientific issues surrounding competing lake restoration proposals are complex, and each scenario offers environmental and economic trade-offs. After decades of foot-dragging, the corporation has predictably offered its own cleanup plan, which involves minimum cost and minimum benefits. Honeywell has negotiated a plan to dredge and clean the most contaminated sediments and bury them in a sealed landfill in the waste beds. That may be a good beginning, but the bulk of the contaminants lie diffused in the sediments spread over the entire lake bottom. From here, they enter the food chain. The Honeywell plan is to leave those sediments in place and cover them with a 4-inch layer of sand that would partially isolate them from the ecosystem. Even if isolation were technically feasible, the proposal is to cap less than half of the lake bottom, leaving the rest to circulate as usual. Onondaga Chief Irving Paulus characterized the solution as a Band-Aid on the lake bottom. Band-Aids are fine for small hurts, but you don't prescribe a Band-Aid for cancer. The Onondaga Nation called for a thorough cleanup of the sacred lake. Without legal title, however, the powers that be will not give the nation an equal place at the negotiating table. The hope was that history would turn itself to prophecy as the Onondaga Nation combed the snakes from the hair of Allied Chemical. While others quarreled over cleanup costs, the Onondaga took a stance that reversed the usual equation in which economics takes priority over well-being. The Onondaga Nation land rights action stipulated a full cleanup as part of the restitution. No halfway measures would be accepted. Non-native people of the watershed joined with them as allies in their call for healing in an extraordinary partnership, the neighbors of the Onondaga Nation. In the midst of legal wrangling, technical debates, and environmental models, it is important to not lose sight of the sacred nature of the task, to make this most profaned lake worthy of the work of water again. The spirit of the peacemaker still walks along these shores. The legal action concerned not only rights to the land, but also rights of the land, the right to be whole and healthy. Clan Mother Audrey Shenandoah made the goal clear. It is not casinos and not money and not revenge. In this action, she said, we seek justice. Justice for the waters, justice for the four-leggeds and the wingeds whose habitats have been taken. We seek justice, not just for ourselves, but justice for the whole of creation. In the spring of 2010, the federal court handed down its ruling on the Onondaga Nation suit. The case was dismissed. In the face of blind injustice, how do we continue? How do we live our responsibility for healing? The first time I heard of the place, it was long past saving, but no one even knew. They kept it hidden until one day the sign appeared eerily out of nowhere. H E L P. Green block letters big enough for a football field, just off the highway. But even then, no one paid attention. 15 years later, I moved back to Syracuse, where I had been a student, and watched those letters fade to brown and die away along that busy stretch of road. And yet the memory of that message hadn't faded for me. I needed to see the place again for myself. It was a fine October afternoon, and I had no classes. I wasn't sure exactly how to find the place, but I'd heard rumors. The lake was so blue you could almost forget what it was. I drove past the backside of the fairgrounds, long closed for the season and desolate. But off a dirt road at the perimeter, I found the security gates wide open and swinging in the wind, and I went in, mine the only vehicle in a back lot designed for thousands of fairgoers. It's not like they were maps for what lay beyond the fences, but there was a lane of sorts heading off in the general direction of the lake. So off I went, being sure to lock my car in this lonely place. I'd be just a while, back in plenty of time to pick up my girls after school. The lane was just a rutted track through a thicket of phragmites, the reedy stems so densely packed as to make a wall on either side. I had heard that every summer the manure from the state fair barns was dumped out here. The mucked-out stalls of blue-ribbon dairy cows and midway elephants all ended up on the waste beds. The city later followed suit, dumping tankers of sewage sludge. The resulting paddy was completely overgrown, plumed seed heads towering over my head by several feet. My view of the lake and my sense of direction were lost in the craze of stems, all rubbing and sawing against each other, rocking in the wind with a hypnotic sway. The lane forked off to the left, and then to the right, and became a walled labyrinth without landmarks of any kind. I felt like a rat in a phragmites maze. I took the fork that seemed to go lakeward and began to wish I'd brought my compass. There are 1,500 acres of wasteland along this shore. Even the sound of the highway, usually a good direction finder, was lost in the swishing sound of the reeds. A niggling suspicion that this was not a good place to be alone crept up the back of my neck. But I talked myself out of being afraid. There was absolutely no one here to worry about. Who would be crazy enough to come to this godforsaken place? Who but another biologist, whom I'd be happy to meet? Either that or an axe murderer, disposing of a body in the reeds. It would never be found. I followed the track as it twisted and turned until I caught a glimpse of the top of a cottonwood. I could hear its leaves in the distance, an unmistakable sound. It was a welcome landmark. Another bend in the lane brought the tree into full view. A big cottonwood with thick spreading branches that hung over the road. From the lowest branch hung a human body. Next to it, an empty noose swayed in the wind. I screamed and ran, taking any path I could find, panicked and walled in by the reeds. With a pounding heart, I ran blindly on and on, and then met the dead end of every horror movie. Here in a tableau of terror stood an executioner with a black hood, muscled arms, and, of course, a dripping axe. A woman's body was draped over the chopping block, her blonde curls spilling from her severed head. I did not move. And neither did they. At all. A space had been cut from the thicket to form a reed-walled room like a museum diorama with life-sized figures poised at the point of murder. Relief poured off me in a cold sweat. No dead bodies. But the palpable presence of some twisted imagination was only a marginal improvement over actual corpses. To make matters worse, I was now entirely lost in the maze, wanting only to be somewhere else, most especially picking up my kids from the school bus. Thinking of them, I gathered my wits and moved as quietly as possible, wanting to avoid detection by the satanic cultists I envisioned. On my search for a way out, I encountered additional rooms hacked into the reeds, a mocked-up prison cell with an electric chair, a hospital room with a straight-jacketed patient and an ominous nurse, and finally, an open grave with a long-nailed occupant crawling from it. After another long pass through the eerie reeds, the lane emerged into the parking lot. The light stanchions now cast long shadows, and my car was visible way down at the other end. I padded for my keys in my pocket. Still there. I could probably make it. I couldn't see if the gate was open or closed. I turned for one last look behind me. Off to the side, a nicely lettered sign was pounded into the ground. Solvay Lions Club, Haunted Hayrides, October 24 to 31, 8 p.m. to midnight. I laughed myself silly, but then I had to cry. The Solvay waste beds, how very fitting a venue for our fears. What we ought to be afraid of isn't in the haunts, but under them. Land buried under 60 feet of industrial waste, trickling toxins into the sacred waters of the Onondaga and the home of 500,000 people. Death may be slower than the fall of the axe, but it is just as gruesome. The executioner's face is hidden, but its names are known. Solvay process, allied chemical and dye, allied chemical, allied signal, and now Honeywell. More frightening to me than the act of execution is the mindset that allowed it to happen, that thought it was okay to fill a lake with toxic stew. Whatever the companies are called, individual people were sitting behind those desks, fathers who took their sons fishing, who made the decision to fill the lake with sludge. Human beings made this happen, not a faceless corporation. There were no threats, no extenuating circumstances to force their hands, just business as usual. And the people of the city allowed it to happen. Interviews with Solvay workers tell the typical story. I was just doing my job. I had a family to feed, and I wasn't going to worry about what happened out there on the waste beds.